Good evening. This is Paul Kelly. Sorry for the dead air time. Our little interruption music didn't work, but we've got lots of good things ahead on Speak Up Arkansas. I am here today with folks who are working with an effort to deal with the more than 100 inmates in Arkansas prisons who were sentenced to life without parole when they were juveniles. And I have with me John Dole from the Fair Sentencing Group in Washington. And
Representative Greg Letting.
Representative Greg Letting and Xavier, who is also here. I'm sorry, I'm a little disconcerted right now with all the technical problems, but I appreciate you all being here. I'm really glad we were able to catch you while you were in town, James and Xavier, and appreciate you being here. And Greg, it's really great to have you. I know you're a sponsor on this bill. So, James, you want to give us a little bit of give the audience a little bit of background on this issue and where we are in Arkansas right now.
Absolutely. And first, let me thank you very much, Paul, for having us on the show and for the incredible work that you guys do. I know it's really tough manning the stations and doing all this work by yourselves, but it's so incredibly important. So thank you very much for having us. My name is James Dold. I'm with the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, which is based out of Washington, D.C. We're a national organization and coalition and clearinghouse that works to end the practice of sentencing our nation's youth to die in prison and other extreme sentences for juvenile offenders. We believe full-heartedly that every child has the capacity to grow and change and to be rehabilitated over time, and that no child is a throwaway child, and that no child is born bad. And so that really informs our work and the way that we approach our work at the state level in trying to build bipartisan coalitions to end these terrible practices. Our organization's been around for about 7 years now. And we came about right before a Supreme Court case came down called Graham v. Florida, which really began to kick off all of the work that we've been doing and the work that litigators have been doing around the country. And the Supreme Court, even before that decision in 2005, issued a decision called Roper v. Simmons, which struck down the death penalty for juvenile offenders. What the court held in that case was that juvenile offenders, because they are, you know, because they're different from adults, because their prefrontal cortex isn't fully developed, and that they used part of their brain called the amygdala, which is a more emotive and primitive part of the brain, to make decisions, which is why they are more susceptible to peer pressure. It's why they make irrational decisions, and anybody listening who has a child or a teenager in particular knows that children make these really sort of rash decisions at times. And so the court, relying on this juvenile brain and behavioral development science, struck down the death penalty for juveniles, saying that, you know, there's this strong difference between a juvenile who commits a crime, even a serious crime, an adult who commits the same crime, and we can't impose the nation's harshest possible punishment. 5 years later, in a case called Graham v. Florida, the court struck down life without parole for non-homicide offenses, extending that same logic in the Roper decision. And then just a couple of years, 2 years after that, and then just last year, the court reiterated those decisions, finding that life without parole sentences on their face violate the U.S. Constitution for juvenile offenders because of the fact that children have this great capacity for change and to be rehabilitated over time. So states across the country really have been grappling with how to respond to these decisions and what are the proper mechanisms that we should be using to hold our young people accountable. And a number of states now have eliminated life without parole as a sentencing option wholesale for children, and making sure that they have an opportunity to go before a parole board to have their sentences reviewed after a predetermined period of time. And so that really is what brings us to Arkansas. It's a state that has a significant number of juvenile lifers serving, and there's a number of people who are serving excessive time, 40, 50, 60, 70 years, some for homicide-related offenses, but some for other non-homicide-related offenses. And so we want to make sure that anybody who is convicted in the state as a juvenile has at least the opportunity to have their sentence reviewed by a parole board to see if they've changed, if they've been rehabilitated over time. And it's reflective in our other policies, right? We don't let children vote. They can't serve in the military. They can't enter into contracts. They can't do a whole host of things because we recognize that they have this diminished decision-making capacity. In the same vein, we also have laws in place to protect them from people who would prey upon them because of the fact that they have this vulnerability to certain outside influences and to people who we prey upon them. And so this is really about creating parity in our law, making sure that we're a more just and merciful nation. You know, there's a great quote from former Senator Alan Simpson where he says, you know, if our children aren't deserving of our mercy, who amongst us is? And so this is really a bill and an effort that's about mercy, redemption, and second chances, particularly for our young people.
Right. We actually had an Arkansas case that with this that went to the Supreme Court that was instrumental in this, right?
That's right. Jackson v. Hobbs, and that was the companion case to the Miller v. Alabama decision in 2012. And Contrell Jackson, he was a young man who, at the age of 14, I believe he was an accessory in a crime where he went along with an older defendant, robbed a store. He was the lookout, so he wasn't the person who actually committed the homicide offense. He stood outside of the store while his co-defendant went in, and unfortunately, you know, a struggle ensued, and a person lost their life. And Contrell, under Arkansas's previous laws, got a mandatory life without parole sentence, even though he wasn't inside the store, and even though he did not pull the trigger in that case. And so, in that case, that's what the Supreme Court held, that his sentence violated the Constitution.
Right. Xavier, can you tell us what your childhood was like and what led to your involvement in the criminal justice system?
Yes. Just to say my full name, I'm Xavier McHale Rathbe. I work for the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, a senior advisor and national advocate. What led to my involvement in the criminal justice system, or the juvenile justice system much earlier on, was really a lifehood of challenges that I had to contend with, very much unprepared as a child, in particular, with obviously an underdeveloped brain, with the inability to truly weigh consequences, and most important, to navigate the traumas that I was experiencing because of that lack of capacity. And I think what happened for me more than anything was that I chose to run to the streets at a very young age. That decision came more or less in a very impulsive way, and it was mostly in response to those traumas. I ran to the streets at the age of 11 years old, and within that same year, I joined a gang. Within that very same year, at the age of 11, I was also shot in my face at point blank range. Almost lost my life. Sadly, that wasn't enough to discourage me from the life that I was living. The truth to be told is I was seeking a family, another family. What was mostly unspoken in my childhood, throughout my detentions and throughout the trouble I had experienced, was the fact that I was living in a very abusive and neglectful environment. My mother contended with schizophrenia. My brother was also contending with schizophrenia, untreated and undiagnosed. My stepfather was a very abusive alcoholic, and he would hesitate at nothing to hit me, my siblings, and our dog. This was a weekly ritual, one which I eventually became tired of, and I ran away. And by the time I was 13 years old, unfortunately, I had 19 arrests and 7 convictions. And I remember at that very same age of 13, I was standing in front of a judge, and the judge said that I was incorrigible. He said, Xavier, you're never going to change. When he said that, I didn't really understand what the word meant. And I remember going back to the bullpen, waiting to find out the outcome of my transfer hearing. And I remember the public defender told me, he said, the judge meant that you would never change. And I remember looking back upon my transcripts, and the state's attorney stated, the defendant has an extensive juvenile arrest record indicative of a violent nature, and under no circumstances should be considered for early release. It didn't really dawn on me what he meant until many years later, while I was serving a 25-year sentence. And it dawned on me that what he was saying is that my nature was corrupt, that I had a violent nature, that there was really no redemption within me, and that I was irredeemable in a way that, unfortunately, many of our children have been characterized over the years. Over the years of fear, of crime, over years of kids who have been demonized for things that have taken place, but for the most part were unrecognizable in regards to the causes, you know, in regards to what brought me there. Going in and out of foster care, going in and out of group homes, detention centers, being a victim of violence, witnessing violence, put my life in such a position where eventually I became responsible, unfortunately, for a first degree murder at the age of 13. At that very young age, unfortunately, I didn't fully understand the consequences. I fully didn't even understand the concept of death, to be honest with you. Yeah. It took me some time to fully understand what had taken place and how I was responsible. But fortunately for me, I had a light at the end of the tunnel. I knew that one day I would be free because I was given a 25-year sentence instead of a life sentence. And though a 25-year sentence sound like light years away, one thing that I did have that many individuals who are serving life don't have is I had a small light at the end of the tunnel. The truth is I did grow, I did mature, I did become increasingly more remorseful. I did wake up in a prison cell at the age of 18 and decided that I didn't want to live that life any longer. I did wake up in a prison cell at that very young age and decided to walk out into a prison population and profess that I no longer wanted to be a part of a gang. And in doing that, I risked my life. But at the same time, I was blessed to be surrounded by positive and supportive individuals who were willing to embrace me, to get me enrolled in college courses. Inmates who had been in prison for such a long time that they really had no reason to have compassion, but yet they had so much compassion for me. And I got enrolled at McMurray College at Pontiac Correctional Center. From there, I went to Galesburg Correctional Center, where I got enrolled in Carl Sandburg. Then I got enrolled in Roosevelt University. I ended up getting an Associate of Arts, Associates in General Education, a Bachelor's degree in Social Science. I had a 4.0 GPA, was inducted into the Franklin Honor Society for Outstanding Scholarship, was excelling academically, growing spiritually, and having a dream that slowly was becoming realized. And with that hope of being released one day, I decided to stay out of trouble and stay focused. And by the age of 26, I was able to walk out of prison doors with a bachelor's degree and a mission to advocate on the behalf of at-risk youth, a mission that was driven by a desire not only to live out my eternal apology to society and to the victim's family, but also to create a better legacy for my own life, because I knew that that's not who I really was inside. And so I guess what we're really hoping for here is to provide a light at the end of the tunnel for these individuals so that those who truly change, those who have demonstrated positive change, can have an opportunity. And so they don't have to wake up in a prison cell and looking in the mirror at an aging face and knowing in their heart that they're not the same person, but still have to live out that existential nightmare because of a horrible decision they made when they were children.
Huh. A wonderful story. Wonderful. Thank you for sharing that. That's really, I'm sure that's touched the listeners a great deal, and appreciate you being here.
Appreciate it.
Representative Letting, tell us what the lawmakers are trying to do to address this. I know you've got a bill sponsored, and...
Well, this session, we're still working on drafting a bill, but we should have it very soon. And I know Senator Missy Irvin from Mountain View, Republican from Mountain View, is going to be the lead sponsor in the Senate. And I believe we're going to start the bill down there at this time. We did run a very similar bill 2 years ago in 2015. I had previously worked with James on some human trafficking legislation during the 2013 session. Senator Irvin had also worked with James. And he brought us together again for this effort. It was something that I had never really crossed my radar, but he was very passionate about it, and I went out to D.C. to meet with some of the people he works with and other people like Xavier, and when you heard their stories, it became impossible to not see how important this work was. So we ran a bill in 2015 that was one of the more challenging pieces of legislation on which I've ever worked, but also one of the most rewarding, and we were ultimately able to get it out of House committee and onto the House floor, where it unfortunately failed. But I had a number of colleagues on both sides of the aisle who came up to me after the fact who either had voted no or just hadn't voted, who said that they hadn't really heard about this legislation until that presentation on the House floor that day. This is obviously an emotionally charged issue, and they said they just didn't feel they had enough time to really process it, but they wanted to talk more about it. So that gave us some encouragement. Here we are in 2017 to try again. There have been some additional Supreme Court rulings since that last effort that really made it clear that Arkansas has to act and do something. And I think we're finding more support, again, on both sides of the aisle. This really isn't a partisan issue, though I think, as James alluded to, some of the most conservative states in our country have really led the way on this, including, you know, Texas, Utah, Wyoming, South Dakota. So, you know, I think it's absolutely bipartisan, but again, I think it's fair to say that conservatives are leading on this particular issue. Something I also didn't realize until we began this effort 2 years ago was that despite being 32nd in size in terms of our state's population, we had the fifth largest number of inmates sentenced to life without parole as juveniles. And that was really amazing to me. And somewhat discouraging. So anything we can do to correct that and give individuals who deserve a second chance, I think is absolutely important.
Well, thank you. We have more discussion, but I want to remind our listeners that they can be a part of this conversation. They can give a call here at 501-433-0088 and ask a question or just be a part of the conversation. We'd love to have you join us. So let's talk a little bit about what other states might be doing. What are other states doing to address this?
Yeah. So, you know, everyone's a little bit of a different place. There were some states that were very proactive, even ahead of some of these Supreme Court decisions that came out, in large part because of the fact that.
Good afternoon. You're on the air.
Hey, I wanted to comment on the story that young man Xavier, I believe, just gave.
Yes.
Listen, that was it really made you think. Because if you had asked me before I heard his story of what the possibility of parole meant for him when he was in prison, I would have just focused on the crime and you killed somebody, and I think I don't want that person released to kill somebody else, you know. But so I would have been in favor of life imprisonment without parole, no matter what your age was when you committed the crime. But to actually hear somebody who, it sounds to me like that person changed his life.
Thank you.
That makes a big difference. And I hope that the legislators who will be voting on a bill this year, I hope they hear his story or a story like his before they cast their vote.
Thank you so much. You know, first of all, I really appreciate your words. You know, I want to clarify something that's very important to me that I share this, and that is that I'm not the exception to the rule. Also, you know, I'm very fortunate to be a part of a great national network called the Incarcerated Children's Advocacy Network. Currently, we have 45 members in 18 states, and many of these individuals have stories much like mine. In fact, some of them were actually sentenced to life without parole in childhood, but because of the legal interventions, U.S. Supreme Court decisions, and other matters, they were able to come out, reinvent themselves, recreate their lives, and be living examples of positive change. So I just want to clarify, I'm certainly not the exception to the rule, but I was definitely given exceptional opportunities, and I'm very appreciative of that, and I'm mostly appreciative of your words, because that is what we hope to accomplish here, to help people recognize the humanity of these children, to recognize their great potential, and that no child is born bad. Thank you.
Thank you, sir, for your call and your comments. All right. Amen.
And that's such a powerful call, and to hear Xavier's words, and I think, you know, that's also reflected in a lot of our values that we have as a society. You know, and a lot of people approach this issue from different perspectives, and one perspective that some people come at this from is a religious perspective. And, you know, the Bible is replete with examples of individuals who committed very great sins but went on to serve a very high purpose and with God's calling. You know, when we think about Moses, the Apostle Paul, David, all of these are examples of individuals who committed murder in the Bible and yet changed significantly in their lives. And so, you know, not only is Xavier that example, but, you know, God teaches us that there's these great examples of people to find redemption and have a second chance at life.
Right, right. So, what can our listeners do to get involved in this effort?
They should certainly reach out to lawmakers, particularly those on both the House Judiciary Committee and the Senate Judiciary Committee, and make sure they know that they support this legislation and why they support this legislation. And if they know people in their lives with stories similar to Xavier's, make sure that they share those stories. That's really one of the best things you can do. And if you are in a position, I know it can be very difficult to get to the Capitol, particularly considering that we meet on weekdays, but there is really also no substitution for showing up in person and being able to share your feelings on a piece of legislation face to face with your lawmaker. So if you are able to do that, that's a great thing to do. But again, an email or a phone call can also be a very powerful thing.
All right. Reminding you, you can call at 501-433-0088 and be part of this conversation. Can we talk a little bit more about the types of kids who get these sentences in Arkansas? Now, exactly how many? And you know, I know it. I think it's over 100. Is that correct?
That's correct. There's about 116 individuals that are serving life without parole sentences. That does not include, for crimes committed as children, that does not include the de facto sentences, the de facto life sentences, so individuals who are serving 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 100 years plus, where they will never have an opportunity to come out of prison unless there's some sort of legal intervention, either through the courts or through the legislature acting. And this, again, gets to the Supreme Court issue. But I think, you know, the question really goes to, at the heart of it, which is what Xavier was describing in his story. In the studies that have been done about juvenile lifers serving across the United States, they come from some of the most disinvested and broken communities that we have in our country. Over 50% of our kids that were sentenced to life without parole were physically abused as children. Over 20% were sexually abused. For girls who are serving these sentences, the number that were sexually abused is 80%. Over a third of them were homeless or transient at the time that their crime was committed, and over 80% of them witness violence in their neighborhood on a weekly and ongoing basis. And so really, when we step back and we look at the environments in which these kids have been raised, in which they sort of came out of, it's not really shocking or surprising in many ways that they ended up gravitating towards the streets. And I think Xavier described it as sort of looking for love and acceptance in the wrong places because he wasn't getting that at home. And that's what happens with so many of these kids. And I would also be remiss if I didn't talk about the, you know, the racial dynamics of these issues. You know, oftentimes what we see in terms of the sentencing and the, these types of sentences and how they've been imposed, it disproportionately impacts the African American community. And what we've seen is that black children are sentenced at a per capita rate of 10 times that of other youth. And so this is certainly an issue where we see African American children impacted disproportionately. And that goes back to, you know, sort of cycles of poverty and sort of you can take it all the way back to slavery, Jim Crow in the South, and sort of how the criminal justice system has interacted, particularly with youth of color. And so I think that's an important component as we talk about these issues and why it's so important to talk about race when we're talking about criminal justice reform. But in terms of what these kids look like and sort of who they are some of the most you know, victimized kids in our community. Now, it doesn't excuse what they did. They still need to be held accountable, and it's important that we hold them accountable, but it's important that we understand the backgrounds of these children before we condemn them to die in prison. And that's what this legislation really is about, too, is making sure that the parole board has the ability to look at these kids' backgrounds, their circumstances, where they came from in life.
Yeah, you know, it's, and this is Xavier again, you know, to answer your question, you know, who are these individuals, right? And I don't know, I'm very fortunate to know quite a few people who were once sentenced to these type of consequences as children, and many of them are still in prison. Many of them are there, but I'm very fortunate also to know folks who have been able to have a second chance. The likes of, you know, Sarah Kuzan, who now lives in California. She was a victim of tremendous trauma growing up. Her case was unique in that she was trying to escape that trauma and made a horrible mistake. But fortunately, although she was deemed as, you know, the worst of the worst, that later on society with the evolving adolescent and brain research, we came to recognize that children are impetuous, risk-taking, that the prefrontal cortex isn't fully formed. And when she was faced with a decision as a child, she felt she could not extract herself from her situation, and she responded very impulsively. But I remember her saying that almost instantly after what happened, she fell to her knees, dropped the gun, and she cried and asked God for forgiveness. I think that oftentimes we forget that children don't know how to escape very horrendous situations at times. At the age of 13 years old, I had 19 arrests and 7 convictions, but to be quite honest with you, I didn't have any other model of life. I didn't sense that there was good in this world. Everyone from a foster mother to two very abusive stepfathers to my biological father to, you know, many others in my life, you know, I was just a punching bag, unfortunately. I was someone who was not tolerated and cared for, who had no compassion offered to him at a very young age. I remember being in a hospital, being questioned by the police when I was shot in my face. And when I refused to tell them who shot me in my face, They arrested me 2 weeks later for obstruction of justice. I was 11 years old. I was a victim in that situation, but because I refused to tell who shot me, I was placed in the detention center for the very first time. And from there, I was put on probation, and from there, it was repeated arrest because I violated my probation. And because I was going to a school that I was afraid of going to because of the rival gang that was waiting for me. But because I had a probation officer that didn't understand, I was placed in detention center for not obeying his rules of being able to stay in school. I say all that to say that oftentimes the kids that we're talking about are some of the most misunderstood. But if we meet them in those spaces of their life, whether it's in a home, in detention centers, in schools, in these institutions, and we catch them early and afford them the opportunity to grow and be surrounded by caring adults, to provide them with unconditional positive regard, to provide them with educational opportunities, resources, to address the mental health challenges that exist in their lives, mostly due to trauma, to expose them to a positive peer group, much like many communities across our country do provide, we would see situations like this far less often. But in the same token, I do want to say that when these things do happen, when these tragic outcomes do happen, when these traumas manifest themselves in a very devastating way in the lives of these kids, I ask that as a society, we don't give up on them, that we recognize our responsibility as parents, that we treat them as if we were treating and holding consequences upon our own children, and that in so many ways, that we come to recognize the value of even some international conventions that said that kids are different. You know, we know that through many things that we do in life, that we recognize that kids should be afforded. We know that kids should have clean water, quality education, should be free of hazardous work conditions, shouldn't be exposed to situations that are dangerous, because we recognize that they don't have the capacity to make right decisions. They don't have the capacity to choose even their own health at times, depending, you know, based upon the environments they may find themselves in. Well, violence in the city of Chicago and the South Side in particular is one thing that many kids cannot escape. There are many things that I could point to in our society that are outside the control of our children. But what is within our control and what we can help make possible is to try to provide that safe and sacred space where they can grow, thrive, and become who they are. And that mission as adults, as human beings, should never be stopped, regardless of their mistakes, regardless of what they've ever done. We should always recognize our responsibility, our moral obligation to our children, because they are the ones that we are truly here for. That is what we work for. That's what we create families for, to recognize that the children in our society are most sacred. And in order for us to really live out our humanity, we must recognize the most vulnerable in our society and tend to their needs.
Thank you for that. Representative Letting, what's the next step? I know you say you have a draft, but what's sort of the time frame, or when can our listeners start hearing about this or start doing something about it?
Well, it's never too soon to start doing something about it. I, if you're out there and listening and this is something you support, I would start contacting lawmakers at the Capitol. We hope, again, to have a bill perhaps as early as tomorrow, but certainly by the end of the week, that we hope will be ready to file, if not this week, early next week. As I believe I mentioned earlier, Senator Ervin is going to start this bill in the Senate, so it'll go through the Senate Judiciary Committee, which I believe will meet next Wednesday. So it could be run that early, and if it gets out of committee that day, it could be out of the Senate and into the House the next week. I would just want to quickly add that I don't know any better advocate for incarcerated youth than Xavier. I mean, he does such an amazing job in the time that I have known him. Just your own powerful personal story, but your ability to speak to the importance of this is just absolutely incredible.
Thank you.
Welcome. But I also wanted to briefly mention another woman who joined the effort in 2015, another advocate from the victim side, Linda White from Houston, Texas, whose daughter was brutally murdered by two young men. And after a period of time, she actually reached out to these young men. And obviously it was difficult and painful, but over time developed a relationship, and she began to see the need for the opportunity for a second chance. And so now she goes around the country advocating for a change to the law.
Thank you, James, Xavier, and Greg. This was a wonderful discussion. I really appreciate you all coming in.
You're welcome.
And,
thank you.
Tune in to Speak Up Arkansas every Wednesday at 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening. You're listening to KABF 88.3.
Hi, this is Alanis Morissette, and you're listening to KABF 88.3 in Little Rock, the voice of the people.
It's time for Radio Cals, a weekly program from the Central Arkansas Library System. Every Wednesday from 6 to 6:30 p.m. here on KABF 88.3 FM, we will share with you conversations with interesting Arkansans on primary sources, Chewing the Fat with Rex and Paul, interviews with some of your favorite musical artists on Arkansas Sounds, content from the Butler Center's collections, information